Scene 5. I wasted 10 scenes or so waiting in the dressing room for James to appear. He never did, but I knew better than to go looking for him in the wings. The kind of confrontation we were doomed to have couldn't be confined to the alleys and walkways backstage. Intermission would be my best chance to catch him before he could slip away. As the last scene of Act 3 approached its violent climax, I climbed out of my chair, pulling a jacket on over my bare chest. My madman's rags made me feel naked and vulnerable. The crossover was empty, the lights glowing dull autumnal yellow. I was reaching for the backstage door when Meredith emerged at the other end of the hall. I hadn't really laid eyes on her all night, and for a moment I was frozen in place. She looked like a Grecian princess draped in pale blue chiffon and voile, a band of gold across her forehead, curls falling loosely down her back. I turned and walked right at her, unsure of when I'd find her alone again or what the rest of the night might bring. The sound of my footsteps made her look up, and surprise flashed on her face before I caught her and kissed her as deeply as I dared. "What was that for?" she asked when I leaned back. She knew she was beautiful. I didn't need to tell her that. "You know, you scare the hell out of me," I said, clutching the fabric of her dress to keep her close. "What?" "I don't know. It's like I look at you and suddenly the sonnets make sense. The good ones, anyway." Whatever either one of us had expected me to say, it wasn't that. She blushed, and a little thrill of joy went through me, improbable, inexplicable, given all the other circumstances of the evening. But then it was extinguished like a candle flame, blown by doubt out of existence. "Where were you last night?" I asked. She looked away. I had to go somewhere. I don't understand." "I'll tell you," she said, absently tracing the notch of my collarbone with one fingertip. "Tonight. Later." "All right." I couldn't help wondering if there would be time later. What later even meant. "Later," I agreed anyway. "I have to go." She brushed my hair back off my forehead, a sweet, affectionate gesture of hers, by then familiar and perpetually hoped for. But I worry, and misgivings made my knees weak. "Meredith," I said as she moved toward the girls' dressing room. She paused at the door. "The other day, in class?" I didn't want to say it, but I couldn't stop myself. "Don't kiss James like that again." She stared in blank incomprehension for a moment. Then her expression hardened and she asked, "Who is it that you're jealous of? Him or me?" She made a soft sound of disgust and disappeared through the door before I could reply. My throat seized up. What had I even meant to do? Protect her? Warn her? What? I slammed my open hand against the wall, and the impact stung. It would have to wait. Act 3 was coming to a close. I could hear Colin gasping through the speakers. "Colin, I have received a hurt. Follow me, lady. Turn out that eyeless villain. Throw this slave upon the dunghill. Regan, I bleed apace. Untimely comes this hurt. Give me your arm." I waited by the stage left door, my back against the wall. The lights went out and the audience applauded, weakly at first, and then with greater fervor, shell-shocked by the gruesome tearing out of Gloucester's eyes. Second years spilled out of the wings and hurried past without seeing me. Then Colin. Then Philippa. Then James. I grabbed him by the elbow and steered him away from the dressing rooms. "Oliver, what are you doing?" "We need to talk." "Now?" he said. "Let go, you're hurting me." "Am I?" I had a brutally hard grip on his arm. I was bigger than he was, and for the first time I wanted both of us to be keenly aware of it. I shoved the hall door open, pulling him through after me. The loading dock had been my first thought, but Alexander and some of the second and third years would have gone out to smoke. I considered the basement, but I didn't want to be trapped down there. James asked two or three more questions, all variations on the same theme. Where were we going? But I ignored them, and he fell silent, his pulse quickening under my fingers. The lawn behind the hall was wide and flat, the last open place before the ground sloped downward toward the trees. The real sky was enormous overhead, making our mirrors and twinkling stage lights seem ridiculous, man's futile attempt to imitate God. When we were far enough from the fab that I knew we wouldn't be seen in the dark, much less overheard, I let go of James's arm and shoved him away from me. He stumbled, found his footing, then glanced nervously over his shoulder at the steep drop of the hill behind him. "Oliver, we're in the middle of a show," he said. "What's this about?" I found the boat hook. I wished suddenly for the wild howling wind of the previous night. The stillness of the world beneath the dark dome of the sky was suffocating, massive, unbearable. "I found the boat hook shoved inside your mattress." His face was pale as bone in the raw moonlight. "I can explain." "Can you?" I asked. "Because I've got to open Act 4, so you have 15 minutes to convince me that this isn't what I think it is." "Oliver," he said, and turned his face away. "Tell me you didn't do it." I risked a step closer, afraid to raise my voice above a whisper. "Tell me you didn't kill Richard." He closed his eyes, swallowed, and said, "I didn't mean to." A steel fist clenched in my chest, crushing the air out of me. My blood felt cold, crawling through my veins like morphine. "Oh, God, James. No." My voice cracked, snapped in half. No sound left. "I swear I didn't mean to. You have to understand," he said, coming desperately toward me. I staggered 3 steps back where he couldn't reach. "It was an accident, just like we said. It was an accident, Oliver, please." "No, don't come too close," I said, forcing words out when there was no air for them. "Keep your distance. Tell me what happened." The world seemed to stop on its axis, like a top precariously balanced on its point. The stars gleamed cruelly overhead, shards of glass scattered in the sky. Every nerve in my body was a live wire, shrinking away from the touch of the cold March air. James was colder, carved from ice, not my friend, not even human. "After you went upstairs with Meredith, something happened to Richard," he said. "It was like Halloween, but worse. He came crashing out of the castle in this uncontainable rage. You should have seen it. It was like watching a star explode." He shook his head slowly, terror and awe indistinguishable in his expression. "Ren and I, we were sitting at the table. We had no idea what was happening, but then he just appeared with this look on his face like he would crush anything that got in his way. He was headed for the woods to do what? I have no idea, and Ren tried to stop him." He faltered, squeezed his eyes shut like the memory was too close, too painful, excruciating. "God, Oliver, he grabbed her, and I swear I thought he might just break her in half, but he threw her down in the grass, halfway across the yard. And he stormed off into the trees and left her there just sobbing. It was horrible. I put her back together as best I could, and Pip and I put her to bed. But she wouldn't stop crying, and she kept saying, 'Go after him, he'll hurt himself.' So I went." I opened my mouth in disbelief, but he didn't give me time to say a word. "You don't need to tell me how stupid it was," he said. "I know. I knew then, but I went."
"And you found him?" I could already see it unfolding. A quarrel, a threat, a shove. Too much.
"Not at first," he said. "I stumbled around in the dark like an idiot, calling for him.
Then I had the idea that he might have gone down to the dock. He shrugged, and the motion was so powerless and pathetic that I felt the knot in my chest loosen, just barely. I climbed down the hill, but I didn't see him. I went as far as the boathouse just to make sure he hadn't done something stupid like jump in the water, and when I turned around to go back up, there he was. He'd been following me around in the woods the whole time, like it was some sick sort of game. He was talking faster by then, all the words he'd kept stopped up for months, flooding out at once. And I said, "There you are. Let's go back up. Your cousin's a wreck." And he said, you can guess what he said. It was, "Don't you worry about my cousin." So I said, "Fine. Everyone's upset. Come back and we'll sort it out." And he gave me that look again. God, Oliver, I've been dreaming about it for weeks. It was like all the hate in the world at once. Has anyone ever looked at you like that? For a moment, the same stupefied fear seemed to seize him, but then he shook his head and continued. And that's when it started. The pushing, the taunting. His voice climbed to a high nervous pitch, and he rubbed at his arms, stamped one foot on the ground like he couldn't keep his body warm enough. And he wouldn't stop. It was Halloween again. Come on, let's play a game. I didn't take the bait, and it just got worse. Why don't you fight back? Why don't you get your hands dirty? Let's play a game, little prince. Let's play a game. That's all it was to him. But I was so scared, and I tried, I said, one more time. Why don't you just come back to the castle, and we'll talk to Wren. We'll talk to Meredith. We'll fix it. And then he said... He stopped, his face flushed an ugly red, as if the words were so vile he couldn't repeat them. James, what did he say? He looked up at me sharply, his head tilted back, his mouth a cruel flat line, eyes dark and fathomless. He looked like Richard. He even sounded like him when he spoke. Why can't you and Oliver just admit you're queer for each other and leave my girls alone? I stared at him, throat tight, the cold sweat sensation of dread spreading slowly through my limbs. So I said, James went on, in his own voice again. I don't know who told you otherwise, but you don't own Meredith, and you certainly don't own Wren. Drink yourself to death if you like. I'm going. And he wouldn't let me. What do you mean? He wanted a fight. He wouldn't let me leave without one. I tried to walk past him, but he grabbed me and he threw me against the doors of the boathouse. They're not solid, it's so old, and I kind of crashed inside. Fell against all the stuff piled up in there. And he came at me again, and I just reached for the nearest thing, and it was the boat hook. He stopped, pressed his hand over his eyes like he wanted to wipe the recollection away. His lip trembled. His whole body was trembling. And then what? I didn't want to ask. Didn't want to know. Didn't want to hear another word. And then he laughed, James said weakly from behind his hand. I could almost hear the sound, Richard's deep, dangerous laugh ringing in the dark. He laughed and said, "Do it, pretty boy, little prince. I dare you." And he pushed me again, pushed me down to the end of the dock, saying, "I dare you, I dare you, you won't do it." And I looked behind me, and the water was right there, and all I could think of was Halloween, and who would keep him from drowning me this time? And he wouldn't shut up. He just kept saying it. "You won't do it. I dare you. I dare you. I dare you." And I... His hand slid down to cover his mouth, eyes wide with horror, as if he had just in that moment realized what he had done. "I didn't mean to," he said. A soft little moan from behind his hand. "I didn't mean to, but I was so scared and so angry." I could see it just as it must have happened. A wild, unplanned blow. The painful jolt of impact. Surprise at the hot spray of blood on his face. Richard falling in slow motion toward the water. a sickening splash, and even more sickening silence.
"Oliver, I thought he was dead,"
he said, so faintly I almost didn't hear him.
"I swear I thought he was already dead. And I didn't know what to do, so I just ran. I think I lost my mind for a minute. I ran back into the trees, and I might have kept running all night if I hadn't run right into Philippa."
I felt numb, frozen, stunned into stillness. "You what?" He nodded distractedly like he couldn't quite remember how the rest of it had happened.
"I guess she was worried that I hadn't come back and came out to look for me, and I ran right into her. It's a miracle I didn't hurt her. I still had the fucking hook in my hand. I don't know what made me take it."
"She knew," I said, that one fact skipping and repeating in my brain.
"She knew?" "She was so calm, it was like she expected it. She didn't even ask questions, really, just got me inside and up the stairs somehow. I was shaking so badly she had to help me out of my clothes, but as soon as she left me in the bathroom, went to burn everything with blood on it, I just started throwing up and I couldn't stop until—"
He fell abruptly silent, made a strange gesture toward me, like I was supposed to finish the sentence.
"Oh, God," I said.
"Me." Half asleep, half dressed. Him, heart hammering, crouched on the floor.
"You didn't tell me."
I didn't realize until it was out of my mouth that that alone was worse than any of the rest of it.
"Why didn't you tell me?" "I didn't want you to know," he said.
He took another step toward me, and this time I didn't move back.
"Philippa, maybe she's crazy, I don't know, nothing fazes her but you. Oliver, you—"
His voice failed him, and in its absence he gestured at me again, but it was a thought I couldn't finish for him. "I what, James?"
"I don't understand."
He let his hand fall back to his side, and he gave me that same helpless, hopeless shrug.
"I never wanted you to look at me the way you're looking at me right now."
And maybe there was a kind of terror in my expression, but not for the reason he thought. I looked at him in the cold moonlight, frail and small and scared, and the thousand questions that had come thronging around me every time I looked at him since Christmas melded and fused and shrank until there was really only one.
"Oliver?"
"Yes," I said. That single word accepting everything at once. I couldn't remember when he'd started crying, but tears glistened on his cheeks. He stared at me, mistrustful and confused.
"It's okay,"
I said to myself as much as him. I glanced back toward the fab, calmed somehow as I heard Hamlet in my head again. "The readiness is all." "It'll be okay," I said, though I'd never been less certain of anything. "We'll sort it out, but now we have to go back." I had no idea what "it" meant or what he thought it was supposed to mean. "We have to go back and act like nothing's wrong. We've got to get through tonight, and then we'll worry about it, all right?" Relief, hope, something, finally warmed his face.
"Are you—"
"Yeah,
I am,"
I said, the only possible answer to whatever he wanted to know. "Let's go." I turned toward the fab. He caught my arm.
"Oliver,"
he said, a question clinging to the end of my name. "It's okay," I said again. "Later. We'll figure it out." He nodded, eyes darting down, but I felt his fingers tighten on my arm.
"Come on."
He followed behind me as we ran back to the theater. We slipped in through the side door and separated as I went to the wings and he went the other way toward the bathroom, to wipe all evidence of distress from his face. In that one brief moment, I actually wondered if okay, or something like it, might still be possible. But that is how a tragedy like ours or King Lear breaks your heart, by making you believe that the ending might still be happy until the very last minute. Scene 6. The second half of the show moved swiftly, recklessly forward. I was as mad and distracted as Tom a Bedlam should have been, but Frederick and Gloucester must have noticed a change, for they were both eyeing me suspiciously by the end of the fourth act. Act 5 opened with James directing the movements of his army. He spoke with undeniable urgency, perhaps as desperate as I was to close the show, sequester ourselves in the tower, and figure out what to do next. He spoke shortly to Wren, seemed not to see her, and treated Frederick with the same cold apathy. Camillo approached, flanked by Philippa and Meredith, who looked guilty enough that I believed she might have poisoned someone. I lurked in the shadows upstage, waiting for my entrance and the end. Philippa grew quickly ill and reached for Camilo's arm to steady herself. Philippa.
Sick. Oh, sick.
Meredith, aside. If not, I'll ne'er trust medicine. James, to Camilo, throwing down his glove.
There's my exchange. What in the world he is that names me traitor, villain-like, he lies.
His voice rose to call me from my hiding place. The heralds were summoned, the trumpets sounded. Philippa collapsed and was carried off stage by a bevy of second years. Herald reading. If any man of quality or degree within the lists of the army will maintain upon Edmund, supposed Earl of Gloucester, that he is a manifold traitor, let him appear. He is bold in his defense. I breathed in through the scarf tied over my mouth and nose to disguise me, then entered upstage, one hand on my sword. Me. No, my name is lost. By treason's tooth, bare gnawn and canker bit, yet am I noble as the adversary I come to cope. Camilo.
Which is that adversary?
Me.
What's he that speaks for Edmund, Earl of Gloucester?
James.
Himself. What sayest thou to him?
I spoke a litany of his sins to him, and he listened with keen and intimate attention. When he replied, it was without his usual malice, his usual arrogance. His words were thoughtful, humbly aware of their own falsehood. James.
Back do I toss those treasons to thy head. With the hell-hated lie o'erwhelm thy heart, which, for they yet glance by and scarcely bruise, this sword of mine shall give them instant way, where they shall rest for ever.
We drew our swords, bowed to each other, and our final duel began. We moved almost in unison, blades flashing and gleaming under the artificial stars. I began to gain the upper hand, delivering more blows than I received, maneuvering James toward the narrow mouth of the bridge. Sweat glistened on his forehead and in the hollow of his throat, his footwork growing clumsier. I forced him deep into the unfriendly darkness of the house until he could go no farther. The last ring of steel on steel echoing in my ears, I thrust my rapier under his arm. He grabbed my shoulder, gasped, his own blade clattering down on the mirrored floor of the bridge. I let my sword fall too, slid one arm around his back to take his weight, and looked down to find him staring past me into the gloom of the stage left wing. Gwendolyn was standing there at the edge of the light, her expression blank with shock. Holinshed stood beside her, and Detective Colborne stood beside him, the badge on his hip, glinting in the fiber-optic starlight. James's fingertips dug into my arms. I clenched my teeth and lowered him slowly to the floor. Behind us, Meredith was being ushered from the apron to the wings. Camilo watched her go, his face dark with questions. Meredith,
ask me not what I know.
Camilo, go after her. She's desperate. Govern her.
The last second years left the stage. I crouched over James. The violet sash we used for blood had emerged from the open neck of his shirt, and I drew it out slowly as he spoke.
"What you have charged me with, that have I done," he said. "And more, much more. The time will bring it out."
He shivered under me, and I laid one hand on his chest to keep him still.
"'Tis past, and so am I."
A tired smile formed on his mouth.
"But what art thou that hast this fortune on me? If thou'rt noble, I do forgive thee."
Let's exchange charity. I pulled the scarf away from my face. There was nothing else to do to comfort him. "My name is Edgar, and thy father's son." I glanced toward the wings. Meredith stood beside Colborne, talking close in his ear. When she realized I was watching her, she closed her lips and slowly shook her head. I turned back to James. "The gods are just," I said, "and of our pleasant vices make instruments to scourge us." James laughed brokenly, and I felt something deep between my lungs crack clean in two.
"Thou'st spoken right, 'tis true," he said. "The wheel is come full circle. I am here."
Camillo spoke behind us, but I barely heard him. My next line was meant for him, but I said it to James instead.
"Worthy prince, I know it."
He stared up at me for a moment, then lifted his head and pulled me down to meet him. It was almost a brotherly kiss, but not quite. Too fragile. Too painful. Soft whispers of surprise and confusion swept through the audience. My heart throbbed, and it hurt so badly that I bit his lip. I felt his breath catch and let him go, lowered him to the floor again. Silence lingered over long. Whatever Camilo's line was, he had forgotten it, and so I spoke out of turn. "List a brief tale, and when 'tis told, oh, that my heart would burst." I couldn't remember the rest. Didn't care to. Camilo cut my speech, perhaps to make up for his previous lapse, his voice stumbling and uncertain. James lay limp on the floor, as if Edmund's life had left him, and whatever remained of his own was not enough to move. "Camilo,
if there be more woeful, hold it in, for I am almost ready to dissolve."
I didn't speak again. My voice was forfeit. A second year, realizing that neither James nor I would say another word, came dashing in and shattered the spell of stillness that had descended over the stage.
"Help! Oh, help!"
I let Camilo converse with her. Deaths were tallied and accounted. James's time came to be carried off, but neither of us moved, sorely aware of what waited on the other side of the curtain. Servants and heralds said our lines in shy, unsteady voices. Frederick entered with Wren dead in his arms. He, too, sank to the floor, and despite what anyone could do, died, crushed under the weight of his grief. Camilo, the last bastion of our collapsing world, finished the play as best he could, with a speech that should have been mine. "Camilo,
the weight of this sad time we must obey. Speak what we feel, not what we ought to say. The oldest have borne most. We that are young shall never see so much, nor live so long."
The stars all went out at once. Darkness came plunging down. The audience slid slowly, uncertainly into applause. I clung to James until the lights came up again, then helped him to his feet. Wren and Frederick reanimated like the living dead. Philippa and Meredith and Alexander emerged from the wings without raising their eyes from their feet. We bowed stiffly from the waist and waited for the lights to go out again. When they did, we walked single file toward the wings. The curtain closed behind us, a heavy sweep of velvet shutting out the soft human noise of the audience climbing to its feet, recovering. The work lights burned back to life overhead. The first and second years shrank away from Colborne's unfamiliar face. He came slowly forward from his place beside the line sets, watching James as if there were nobody else in the world.
"Well," he said, "we couldn't play make-believe forever. Are you ready to tell me the truth?"
James wavered beside me, opened his mouth to speak. Before he could make a sound, I moved forward, the decision already made, made in the same instant it flashed into existence. "Yes," I said. Colborne turned toward me in disbelief. "Yes," I said again. "I am." Scene 7. Lights and sirens. Outside, in the insubstantial air, audience members in their best clothes, technicians in black, and actors in costume watched as Walton guided me into the back of a car with Broadwater Police Department branded on the side. Everyone was whispering, staring, pointing, but I could only see my classmates, huddled together just like that day on the dock all over again. Alexander's face was so full of sadness that there was no room left for surprise. In Philippa's expression, there was only a desperate lack of understanding. In Wren's, emptiness. In Meredith's, something violent I couldn't find a word to describe. And on James's face, despair. Richard stood beside them, so solid it seemed a miracle that no one else could see him, eyes burning black, somehow still unsatisfied. I looked down to the handcuffs already glinting on my wrists and sank onto the cracked leather seat of the car. Colborne shut the door, and in the small, quiet darkness, I struggled to breathe. I spent the next 48 hours in windowless interrogation rooms, fingering tiny cups of lukewarm water and answering questions from Colborne, Walton, and two other officers whose names I forgot as soon as I heard them. I told the story as James had told it to me, with only necessary variations. Richard, enraged by my and Meredith's betrayal. Me, swinging the boat hook at his head in a fit of jealous fear. They didn't ask about the morning after. Further performances of Lear were canceled. Following a map I had drawn on the back of Walton's legal pad, Colborne led five cops with flashlights down into the undercroft, where they broke into my locker with a crowbar and bolt cutter. Damning evidence covered in my fingerprints.
"Now," Colborne told me coldly, "might be the time to call your lawyer."
I didn't have one, of course, so she was provided for me. There was no question whether it was homicide, only of what degree. Our best chance, she explained, was to argue imperfect self-defense instead of murder, too. I nodded and said nothing. I declined my phone call to my family. They weren't whom I wanted to speak to. On Monday morning, I was informed of my new status as a pre-trial detainee, but I wasn't sent to county right away. I stayed in Broadwater because, according to Colborne, moving me to a bigger, more crowded facility might mean I never made it to my trial at all. It seemed more likely that he was stalling. Even after I had handed in my written confession, I could tell he didn't quite believe it. After all, he had come to the FAB expecting to arrest James, acting on information provided by an anonymous source. Meredith, I assumed. Perhaps that lingering doubt was why he let me have so many visitors. Philippa and Alexander were the first. They sat side by side on a bench on the other side of the bars. "My God, Oliver," Alexander said when he saw me. "What the hell are you doing in here?" "Just waiting." "Not what I meant." "We've talked to your lawyer," Philippa said. "She asked me to be a character witness." "Not me, though," Alexander added with a sad little twitch of a smile. "Drug problem." "Oh." I looked at Philippa. "Will you do it?"
She folded her arms tightly.
I don't know. I haven't forgiven you for this yet.
I ran a finger along one of the bars between us. I'm sorry.
You have no idea, do you, what you've done?
She shook her head, eyes hard and angry. When she spoke again, her voice was the same.
My dad's been in prison since I was 13. They're going to eat you alive.
I couldn't look at her.
Why?
Alexander asked.
Why did you do it?
I knew he wasn't asking why I killed Richard. I squirmed where I was sitting on my cot, grappled with the question.
It's like Romeo and Juliet, I said eventually.
Philippa made an impatient sort of noise and said,
What are you talking about?
Romeo and Juliet, I said again, and risked glancing up at the two of them. Alexander had slumped against the wall. Philippa was glaring.
Would you change the ending if you could? What if Benvolio came forward and said, I killed Tybalt, it was me?
Philippa hung her head, pushed her hands through her hair.
You fool, Oliver, she said.
I couldn't argue with that. They came back from time to time, just to talk, to tell me what was happening at Delacour, to tell me when my family found out. Philippa was the only one brave enough to speak to my mother on the phone. I wasn't brave enough to speak to her myself. I never heard from my father or Caroline, but I didn't expect to. Colborne found Leah outside the station one morning, sobbing and throwing rocks at the side of the building. She'd fled Ohio in the dead of the night, as I had once done. He brought her in to see me, but she wouldn't speak. She only sat on the bench, staring at me and biting her bottom lip raw. I spent all day apologizing uselessly, and that night Colborne put her on a bus back home. Walton, he assured me, had called my parents to tell them where she was. I didn't see Meredith before my trial and heard of her only through Alexander and Philippa and my lawyer. I should have been desperate for a chance to explain myself, but what would I say? She had her answer by then to the last question she'd asked me. But I thought of her often. More often than I thought of Frederick or Gwendolyn or Colin or Dean Holinshed. I couldn't bear to think of Wren at all. Of course, the only person I really wanted to see was James. He came halfway through the first week of my detention. I would have expected him sooner, but according to Alexander, it was the first time in days he'd even managed to pick himself up off the floor. I was asleep when he arrived, lying on my back on my narrow cot, stuck in the permanent daze that had persisted since intermission of Lear. I sensed someone outside the cell and sat up slowly. James was sitting on the floor in front of the bars, pale and somehow insubstantial, as if he'd been stitched together from scraps of light and memory and illusion, like a patchwork doll. I slid down off the cot, feeling suddenly unexpectedly weak, and sat facing him.
I can't let you do this, he said. I didn't come sooner because I didn't know what to do.
No, I said quickly. I'd played my part, hadn't I? I'd followed Meredith upstairs without thinking what might happen when Richard found out. I'd convinced James to leave Richard in the water when no one else could. I'd made my fair share of tragic mistakes, and I didn't want exoneration.
Please, James, I said, don't undo what I've done.
His voice emerged scratchy and raw from his throat.
Oliver, I don't understand, he said. Why?
You know why. I was done pretending otherwise. I don't think he ever forgave me. After my incarceration, he visited often at first. Every time he came, he asked me to let him make things right. Every time, I refused. I knew by then that I would survive my time in prison, quietly counting down the days until all my sins had been atoned for. But his was a softer soul, sunk in sin to the hilt, and I wasn't sure he would. Every time, he took my refusal a little bit harder. The very last time he came was 6 years after my conviction, 6 months since I'd seen him. He looked older, ill, exhausted.
"Oliver, I'm begging you," he said. "I can't do this anymore."
When I refused again, he pulled my hand across the table, kissed it, and turned to leave. I asked where he was going, and he said,
"Hell. Del Norte. Nowhere. I don't know."
My trial was mercifully short. Philippa and James and Alexander were all dragged in to testify, but Meredith refused to say a word in my defense or otherwise and gave every question the same useless answer.
"I don't remember."
My resolve cracked a little every time I looked at her. Other familiar faces I avoided. Wren's and Richard's parents, Leah's and my mother's, blotchy and tear-stained and distant. When it came time for me to speak for myself, I recited my written confession without emotion or embellishment, as if it were just another monologue I'd memorized. At the end, everyone seemed to be expecting an apology, but I didn't have one to give them. What could I say? "This thing of darkness, I acknowledge mine." We settled on second-degree murder, plus time for obstruction of justice, before the jury ever reached a verdict. A bus took me a few miles downstate. I turned in my clothes and my personal belongings and began my 10-year penance on the same day that the Delacour school year ended. Colborne's face was the last familiar one I saw.
"You know, it's not too late," he said. "If there's another version of the truth, you want to tell me."
I wanted, in some strange way, to thank him for refusing to believe me.
"I am myself indifferent, honest," I admitted. "But yet I could accuse me of such things that it were better my mother had not borne me. What should such fellows as I do, crawling between earth and heaven? We are errant knaves all. Believe none of us."
Epilogue. I feel, at the end of my story, sapped of life, as if I have been bleeding freely for the past few hours instead of simply speaking. "Demand me nothing," I say to Colborne. "What you know, you know. From this time forth, I will never speak a word." I turn away from the tower window and avoid his eyes as I walk past him toward the stairs. He follows me down to the library in respectful silence. Philippa is there, sitting on the couch, a copy of Winter's Tale open in her lap. She looks up, and the fading evening light darts across her glasses. My heart is a little lighter at the sight of her.
"It is almost morning," she says to Colborne, "and yet I am sure you are not satisfied of these events in full."
"Well, I can't ask much more of Oliver," he says. "He's confirmed a few long-standing suspicions."
"Will you rest easier with one less mystery on your mind?"
"Honestly, I don't know. I thought some closure would make it more bearable, but now I'm not so sure."
I drift to the edge of the room and stare down at the long black burn on the carpet. Now that I've told Colborne everything, I feel unmoored. I have nothing of my own now, not even secrets. The sound of my name makes me turn back toward the others.
"Oliver, will you tolerate one last question?" Colborne asks.
"You can ask," I say. "I won't promise to answer."
"Fair enough."
He glances at Philippa, then looks back at me again.
"What's next for you? I'm just wondering. What happens now?"
The answer is so obvious, I'm surprised it hasn't occurred to him. I hesitate at first, protective of it, but then I meet Philippa's eyes, and I realize she's wondering too.
"I'm supposed to go stay with my sister. You remember Leah? She's doing her doctorate at Chicago," I say.
"I wouldn't blame the rest of my family if they didn't want to see me. But more than that,
You must know, more than anything. I just need to see James. Something strange happens now. I don't see in their faces the exasperation I'm expecting. Instead, Colborne turns toward Philippa, eyes wide with alarm. She sits up straighter on the couch and lifts one hand to stop him speaking. "Pip," I say. "What's wrong?" She stands slowly, smoothing invisible wrinkles from the front of her jeans. "There's something I haven't told you." I swallow, fighting an urge to run out of the room and never find out what she means to say next. But I stay where I am, glued to the spot by the fear that not knowing is worse. "I was afraid that if I told you while you were inside, you'd never want to come out," she says. "So I waited." "Tell me what?" I say. "Tell me what?" "Oh, Oliver," she says, her voice a distant echo of itself. "I'm so sorry. James is gone." The world drops out from underneath me. My hand gropes blindly for the bookshelf beside me, for something to hold on to. I stare down at the burn on the carpet, listening for my own heartbeat and hearing nothing. "When?" is all I manage to say.
4 years ago," she says quietly. 4 years ago now.
Colborne bows his head. Why? Is he ashamed that he dragged the story out of me and all the while he knew, and I didn't? "How did it happen?" I ask.
"Slowly." "It was the guilt, Oliver," she says. "The guilt was killing him. Why did you think he stopped visiting?"
There's a note of desperation in her voice, but I have no pity for her. There's no room for that. No room for anger, either. Only a catastrophic sense of loss. Philippa is still talking, but I hardly hear the words.
"You know how he was. If we felt everything twice, he felt it all 4 times.
"What did he do?" I demand. Her words are tiny, barely audible.
"He drowned,"
she says.
"He drowned himself. God, Oliver, I'm so sorry. I wanted to tell you when it happened, but I was so afraid of what you might do."
I can tell she's no less afraid now.
"I'm sorry."
I am wretched. Destitute. Suddenly, it seems there is a fourth person in the room. For the first time in 10 years, I look at the chair that had always been Richard's and find it isn't empty. There he sits, in lounging, leonine arrogance. He watches me with a razor-thin smile, and I realize that this is it, the denouement, the counterstroke, the end-all he was waiting for. He lingers only long enough for me to see the gleam of triumph in his half-lidded eyes. Then he, too, is gone. "So," I say when I have just enough strength to speak. "Now I know." I don't speak again until we bid goodbye to Colborne at the hall. The day is over now, night falling as we walked back through the woods to seal us in a world of darkness. There are no stars tonight. "Oliver," Colborne says when we find ourselves standing in the shadow of the hall again, "I'm sorry today ended this way."
"I'm sorry for a lot of things."
"If I can ever do anything for you, well, you know how to find me." He looks at me differently than he ever has, and I realize he's forgiven me, finally, now that he knows the truth. He holds out one hand, and I accept it. We shake, then we go our separate ways. Philippa is waiting for me by the car.
"I'll take you anywhere you want," she says. "If you promise, I won't have to worry."
"No," I say. "Don't do that. We've worried enough for a lifetime, don't you think?"
"Enough for 10.
I lean on the car beside her, and we stand there for a long time staring up at the hall. The Delacour coat of arms stares back down at us in all its delusional grandeur.
"Oh, is all forgot?" I ask. "All school days, friendship, childhood innocence?"
I wonder if Philippa will recognize the line. It was hers once, in the easy days of our third year, when we all thought ourselves invincible.
"We'll never forget it," she says. "That's the worst part."
I scuff my toes in the dirt.
"There's one thing I still don't understand, though."
"What?"
"If you knew all along, why didn't you tell anyone?"
"God, Oliver, isn't it obvious?"
She shrugs when I don't answer. "You all were the only family I had. I'd have killed Richard myself if I thought it would keep the rest of you safe."
"I do understand that," I say, privately thinking that if it had been her, we probably would have gotten away with it. And really, it could have been any one of us.
"But me, Pip. Why couldn't you tell me?"
"I knew you better than you knew yourself," she says, and I can hear 10 years of sadness in her voice.
"I was terrified you'd do exactly what you did."
My martyrdom is not the selfless kind. I can't look at Philippa, shamed by all the injuries I've inflicted, like a man with a bomb strapped to his chest, ready to blow himself up without a thought for the collateral damage.
"How are Frederick and Gwendolyn?" I say, grasping at something easier to talk about. I forgot to ask.
"Gwendolyn's just the same," she tells me with a shadow of a smirk, which fades as soon as it appears. "Except I think she keeps the students at a bit of a distance now."
I nod, don't comment. "And Frederick?"
"He still teaches, but he's slowing down," she says. "It took a lot out of him. Took a lot out of all of us. But they wouldn't need me directing if it hadn't, so I guess it's not all bad."
"I guess not," I say, a hollow echo. "And Camilo?"
I don't know how it started, but I have my suspicions about Thanksgiving of our fourth year, how distracted we were not to notice. She gives me a small guilty smile.
"He hasn't changed at all. Asks about you every 2 weeks when I come home."
In the short pause that follows, I almost forgive her.
"Every 2 weeks."
"Will you marry him?" I ask. "It's been long enough."
"He says the same thing. You'd come back for that, wouldn't you? I'd need someone to give me away."
"Only if Holinshed officiates." It's not as firm a promise as she wants, but she won't get that. James is gone, and I'm sure of nothing now. We stand side by side for a little longer without speaking. Then she says,
"It's getting late. Where can I take you? You know, you're welcome to stay with us."
"No," I say. "Thanks. The bus station would be fine." We climb into the car and drive in silence. I have not been to Chicago in 10 years, and it takes much longer than it should for me to find the address Philippa reluctantly wrote down. It is an unassuming but elegant townhouse which murmurs of money and success and a desire not to be disturbed. For a long time before I knock on the door, I stand on the sidewalk, staring up at the bedroom window where a soft white light glows. It's been 7 years since the last time I saw her, the only time she visited, to tell me I wasn't fooling anyone. At least, not her.
"That shirt in the locker," she said. "It wasn't yours. Not from that night. I ought to know."
I breathe in as deeply as I can, my lungs still feel too small, and knock. As I wait on the porch in the warm summer shadows, I wonder if Philippa warned her. When she opens the door, her eyes are already wet. She slaps me hard across the face, and I accept the blow without protest. I deserve much worse. She makes a small sound of wounded satisfaction, then opens the door wide enough to let me in. Meredith is as perfect as I remember her. Her hair is shorter now, though not by much. She wears her clothes a little looser, too, but again, not much. We pour wine, but don't drink it. She sits on a chair in the living room, and I sit on the couch beside it, and we talk. We talk for hours. There's a decade of things we haven't said. "I'm sorry," I say when there's a pause long enough for me to screw my courage to the sticking place. "I know I have no right to ask, but what happened with you and James in Gwendolyn's class? Did it ever happen offstage?" She nods, not looking at me. "Once, right afterward. We thought we were going our separate ways, but then I walked into the music room and there he was. I wanted to go right back out again, but he grabbed me and we just..." I know what must have happened without her telling me. "I don't know what made us do it. I needed to understand you and him and how he'd wrapped you quite so tight around his finger. I couldn't think of any other way," she says. "But it was over as soon as it started. We heard someone coming. Philippa, of course. She must have known something was wrong and sort of came to our senses. Then we just stood there. And he said, 'What are you thinking about?' And I said, 'The same thing you're thinking about.' We didn't even need to say your name." She frowns down into the red pool of her wine. "It was just a kiss, but God, it hurt like hell." "I know," I say without resentment. Which of us could say we were more sinned against than sinning? We were so easily manipulated, confusion made a masterpiece of us. "I thought it was over then," she says, her voice strained and uncertain. "But the night of the Lear party, I was in the bathroom, fixing my makeup, and I felt a hand on my waist. At first, I thought it was you, but it was him, and he was drunk and talking like a crazy person. I shoved him off and said, 'James, what is the matter with you?' And he said, 'You wouldn't believe me if I told you.' He grabbed me again, but it was violent, painful. He said, 'Or maybe you're the only one who would, but why object? What's done is done, and even-handed justice for us both.' And that was enough. I knew. I got away, barely. Got out of the castle and went straight to Colborne. I told him everything I could. Not about the dock, not that morning, but everything else. And I wanted to tell you, right there in the crossover, but I was afraid you would do something stupid, like help him run off in the middle of intermission. I never thought—" Her voice fades out. "Meredith, I'm sorry," I say. "I didn't think. I didn't care what happened to me, but I should have thought about what would happen to you." She won't look at me, but she says, "There's one thing I need to know now." Of course. I owe her that much. "Us. All that time. Was any of it real, or did you know all along, and we were just a get-out-of-jail-free card for James?" She glares at me with those dark green eyes, and I feel sick. "God, Meredith, no. I had no idea," I tell her. "You were real to me. Sometimes I thought you were the only real thing." She nods like she wants to believe me, but there's something else in the way. She says, "Were you in love with him?" "Yes," I say simply. James and I put each other through the kind of reckless passions Gwendolyn once talked about, joy and anger and desire and despair. After all that, was it really so strange? I am no longer baffled or amazed or embarrassed by it. Yes, I was. It's not the whole truth. The whole truth is, I'm in love with him still. I know. She sounds exhausted. I knew then, I just pretended not to. So did I. So did he. I'm sorry. She shakes her head, stares out the dark window for a moment.
I'm sorry too, you know, about him.
It hurts too much to talk about. My teeth ache in my head. I open my mouth to speak, but what comes out instead is a gasp, a sob, and the grief that shock has kept at bay crashes through me like a flood. I pitch forward, that strange, twisted laugh that's been stuck in my throat for 10 years finally bursting out. Meredith lurches out of her chair and knocks her wine glass to the floor, but ignores the sound of it shattering. She says my name and a dozen other things I barely hear. Nothing is so exhausting as anguish. After a quarter of an hour, I am utterly spent, my throat ragged and aching, my face hot and sticky with tears. I lie on the floor with no memory of how I got there, and Meredith sits cradling my head as if it's a fragile, precious thing that might at any moment break. When I've been silent for another half hour, she helps me to my feet and leads me to bed. We lie side by side in solemn darkness. All I can think of is Macbeth. He has James's face in my imagination, shouting, "Sleep no more! Macbeth does murder sleep, so sleep no more!" O balm of hurt minds! I want sleep desperately, but do not hope to have it. But I wake up in the morning and blink with swollen eyelids as the sun rises and spills in through the window. Sometime in the night, Meredith has rolled over and is sleeping now with her hair fanned out behind her, her cheek against my shoulder. Though we never talk about it, it is somehow decided that I will stay with Meredith indefinitely. While her professional life is crowded with people, her personal life is a mostly solitary one, the long hours filled with books and words and wine. For a week, we reenact Christmas in New York, but more cautiously. I sit on the couch with a mug of tea at my elbow and a book on my knee, sometimes reading, sometimes staring past the pages. At first, she sits across from me, then beside me. Then she lies with her head in my lap and I run my fingers through her hair. When I explain all this to Leah, I can't tell if she's disappointed or relieved. Alexander calls and we agree to meet for drinks next time he's in the city. I don't hope to hear from Wren. Meredith tells me she's in London, working as a dramaturg and living like a recluse, afraid of the outside world. We don't talk about James again. I know that whatever else happens, we never will. Philippa calls and asks for me. She says there's something in the mail. 2 days later, it arrives, a plain brown envelope with a smaller white envelope inside. The sight of James's handwriting on the second one stops my heart for a moment. I hide it under a couch cushion and resolve to open it when Meredith is gone. The next week, she's filming in Los Angeles. She puts a new key on the nightstand, kisses me, and leaves me sleeping in what I've come to think of, prematurely perhaps, as our bed. When I wake up again, I retrieve James's letter. I know more by now about what happened. He drove north from the small apartment he'd occupied outside Berkeley and drowned in the icy winter waters of the San Juan Islands. In his car, abandoned on the ferry landing, he'd left his keys, an empty bottle of Xanax, and a pair of almost identical envelopes. The first was unmarked, unsealed, and contained a short, handwritten farewell, but no explanation or confession. He respected, at least, the last request I'd made of him. On the second, he'd written only one word. Oliver. I open it with clumsy fingers. 10 lines of verse are scratched in the middle of the page. It's James's writing still, but more jagged, as if it had been written hastily, with a pen that had little ink left to give. I recognize the text, a disjointed mosaic monologue cobbled together from an early scene of Pericles. Alas, the sea hath cast me on the rock, washed me from shore to shore, and left me breath, nothing to think on but ensuing death. What I have been, I have forgot to know, but what I am, want teaches me to think on. A man
thronged up with cold, my veins are chill, and have no more of life than may suffice to give my tongue that heat to ask your help, which if you shall refuse when I am dead, for that I am a man, pray see me buried.
I read it 3 times, wondering why he would choose such a strange, obscure passage to leave me, until I remember I haven't heard these words since he chanted them to me, lying drunk in the sand on some beach in Del Norte, as if he'd been washed up beside me by the tide. I am all too aware of my own desperate need to find a message in the madness, and as it takes shape, I am suspicious, afraid to hope. But the implications of the text and its small part in our story are impossible to ignore, too critical for a scholar as meticulous as James to overlook. When I can't stand another moment's inaction, I race up the stairs to the office, my head full of what would have been Pericles' last words if he had not asked for help. The computer on the desk crackles to life when I touch the mouse, and after 1 interminable minute I am on the internet, searching for every record I can find of James Farrow's death in the bleak midwinter of 2004. I devour 5, 6, 10 old articles, all of which say the same thing. He drowned himself on the last day of December, and though the local authorities dragged the freezing water for days and miles, his body was never found. Author's note. In the writing of this book, I have consulted so many different editions of the complete works and the individual plays that it would be impossible to list all of them without the bibliography becoming longer than the story itself. However, a few volumes do stand out as worthy of mention and of my eternal gratitude. The Riverside Shakespeare, second edition, has been a nearly constant companion not only in the writing of this book, but in every Shakespearean endeavor I have embarked on since it first came into my possession in 2010. More recently, and especially in the intricate process of revision, I came to rely on the Norton Shakespeare, third edition, with its groundbreaking commitment to preserving both wonder and resonance, as Stephen Greenblatt described it at the launch party in October 2015. Like the Riverside, it has become indispensable, especially in navigating the textual maze that is King Lear. 2 other books that it would be remiss not to mention are Patsy Roddenberg's Speaking Shakespeare, which had a significant influence on Gwendolyn's theatrical philosophies, and René Girard's Theater of Envy, which might have prevented much of what goes wrong for the 4th years had Oliver read it a little sooner. Here I must also acknowledge that I have ransacked Shakespeare's entire oeuvre with giddy abandon. The 4th-year thespians speak a kind of pidgin English so saturated with Shakespearean words and quotes and turns of phrase that it could almost be classified as a new, and there is no denying, exceptionally pretentious dialect. Because it is a natural and unregulated phenomenon, in some instances, quotes borrowed from the bard are not borrowed word for word. This is the creative liberty of language. For the purposes of this particular story, the texts of Shakespeare and his collaborators, whoever they may have been, are always filtered either through the characters' mouths and/or Oliver's brain, and so are subject to small transformations. The vagaries of early modern orthography have been regularized for the contemporary reader, and I have punctuated the text in whatever manner best serves the speaker or the scene. As James remarks in Act 5, commas belong to the compositors. But whatever small discrepancies there may be, every line of If We Were Villains is written with the intention of paying homage to William Shakespeare, who has had more than enough defamers, detractors, and deniers. Lord, what fools these mortals be.
We hope you've enjoyed If We Were Villains, a Macmillan audiobook production from Flatiron Books. Text copyright 2017 by M.L. Rio.
production, copyright 2017 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.